compassion. He unshaded his face after a little while and spoke steadily. "Don't be afraid to hear me. Don't shrink from anything I say. I'm like one who has died young. All my life might have been. No, Mr. Carton, I'm sure that the best part of it might still be. I'm sure that you might be much, much worthier of yourself. Say, of you, Miss Manette. And although I know better, although in the mystery of my own wretched heart I know better, I shall never forget it." She was pale and trembling. He came to her relief with a fixed despair of himself, which made the interview unlike any other that could have been Holden. "If it had been possible, Miss Manette, that you could have returned the love of the man you see before yourself, flung away, wasted, drunken, poor creature of misuse, as you know him to be, he would have been conscious this day and hour, in spite of his happiness, that he would bring you to misery, bring you to sorrow and repentance, blight you, disgrace you, pull you down with him. I know very well that you can have no tenderness for me. I ask for none. I'm even thankful that it cannot be. Without it, can I not save you, Mr. Carton? Can I not recall you, forgive me again, to a better course? Can I in no way repay your confidence? I know this is a confidence," she modestly said, after a little hesitation and in earnest tears. "I know you would say this to no one else. Can I turn it to no good account for yourself, Mr. Carton?" He shook his head. "To none. No, Miss Manette, to none. If you will hear me through a very little more, all you can ever do for me is done. I wish you to know that you have been the last dream of my soul. In my degradation, I've not been so degraded, but that the sight of you with your father and of this home made such a home by you has stirred old shadows that I thought had died out of me. Since I knew you, I have been troubled by a remorse that I thought would never approach me again, and have heard whispers from old voices impelling me upward that I thought was silent for ever. I have had unformed ideas of striving afresh, beginning anew, shaking off sloth and sensuality, and fighting out the abandoned fight. A dream. All a dream that ends in nothing and leaves the sleeper where he lay down. But I wish you to know that you inspired it. Will nothing of it remain? Oh, Mr. Carton, think again. Try again. No, Miss Manette, all through it I've known myself to be quite undeserving, and yet I have had the weakness, and have still the weakness, to wish you to know with what a sudden mastery you kindled me, heap of ashes that I am, into fire. A fire, however, inseparable in its nature from myself, quickening nothing, lighting nothing, doing no service, idly burning away. Since it is my misfortune, Mr. Carton, to have made you more unhappy than you were before you knew me... Don't say that, Miss Manette, for you would have reclaimed me if anything could. You will not be the cause of my becoming worse, since the state of your mind that you describe is, after all events, attributable to some influence of mine. This is what I mean. If I can make it plain, can I use no influence to serve you? Have I no power for good with you at all? The utmost good that I am capable of now, Miss Manette, I have come here to realize. Let me carry through the rest of my misdirected life the remembrance that I opened my heart to you, last of all the world, and that there was something left in me at this time which you could deplore and pity. which I entreated you to believe again and again, most fervently, with all my heart, was capable of better things, Mr. Carton. Entreat me to believe it no more, Miss Manette. I have proved myself, and I know better. I distress you. I draw fast to an end. Will you let me believe, when I recall this day, that the last confidence of my life was reposed in your pure and innocent breast, and that it lies there alone, and will be shared by no one? If that will be a consolation to you, yes. Not even by the dearest one ever to be known to you? Mr. Carton, she answered after an agitated pause, the secret is yours, not mine, and I promise to respect it. Thank you. And again, God bless you. He put her hand to his lips and moved towards the door. Be under no apprehension, Miss Manette, of my ever resuming this conversation by so much as a passing word. I will never refer to it again. If I were dead, I could not be surer than it is henceforth. In the hour of my death, I shall hold sacred the one good remembrance, and shall thank and bless you for it, that my last avowal of myself was made to you, and that my name and faults and miseries were gently carried in your heart. May it otherwise be light and happy. He was so unlike what he had ever shown himself to be, and it was so sad to think how much he had thrown away, and how much he every day kept down and perverted, that Lucy Manette wept mournfully for him as he stood looking back at her. "Be comforted," he said. "I am not worth such feeling, Miss Manette. An hour or two hence, and the low companions and low habits that I scorn but yield to will render me less worth such tears as those than any wretch who creeps along the streets. Be comforted. But within myself I shall always be towards you what I am now, though outwardly I shall be what you have heretofore seen me. The last supplication but one I make to you is that you will believe this of me."
"I will, Mr. Carton."
"My last supplication of all is this, and with it I will relieve you of a visitor with whom I well know you have nothing in unison, and between whom and you there is an impassable space. It is useless to say it, I know, but it rises out of my soul. For you, and for any dear to you, I would do anything. If my career were of that better kind that there was any opportunity or capacity of sacrifice in it, I would embrace any sacrifice for you and for those dear to you. Try to hold me in your mind at some quiet times as ardent and sincere in this one thing. The time will come. The time will not be long in coming, when new ties will be formed about you, ties that will bind you yet more tenderly and strongly to the home you so adorn, the dearest ties that will ever grace and gladden you. Oh, Miss Manette, when the little picture of a happy father's face looks up in yours, when you see your own bright beauty springing up anew at your feet, think now and then that there is a man who would give his life to keep a life you love beside you." He said, "Farewell," said at last, "God bless you," and left her. Chapter 14. The Honest Tradesman. To the eyes of Mr. Jeremiah Cruncher, sitting on his stool in Fleet Street with his grisly urchin beside him, a vast number and variety of objects in movement were every day presented. Who could sit upon anything in Fleet Street during the busy hours of the day and not be dazed and deafened by two immense processions, one ever tending westward with the sun, the other ever tending eastward from the sun, both ever tending to the plains beyond the range of red and purple where the sun goes down. With his straw in his mouth, Mr. Cruncher sat watching the two streams, like the heathen rustic who has for several centuries been on duty watching one stream, saving that Jerry had no expectation of their ever running dry. Nor would it have been an expectation of a hopeful kind, since a small part of his income were derived from the pilotage of timid women, mostly of a full habit and past the middle term of life, from Tellson's side of the tides to the opposite shore. Brief as such companionship was, in every separate instance, Mr. Cruncher never failed to become so interested in the lady as to express a strong desire to have the honour of drinking her very good health. And it was from the gifts bestowed upon him towards the execution of this benevolent purpose that he recruited his finances, as just now observed. Time was when a poet sat upon a stool in a public place and mused in the sight of men. Mr. Cruncher, sitting on a stool in a public place, but not being a poet, mused as little as possible, and looked about him. It fell out that he was thus engaged in a season when crowds were few, and belated women few, and when his affairs in general were so unprosperous as to awaken a strong suspicion in his breast that Mrs. Cruncher must have been flopping in some pointed manner, when an unusual concourse pouring down Fleet Street westward attracted his attention. Looking that way, Mr. Cruncher made out that some kind of funeral was coming along, and that there was popular objection to this funeral, which engendered uproar. "Young Jerry," said Mr. Cruncher, turning to his offspring, "it's a burying." "Hurrah, father!" cried young Jerry. The young gentleman uttered this exultant sound with mysterious significance. The elder gentleman took the cry so ill that he watched his opportunity and smote the young gentleman on the ear.
"What do you mean? What you were roaring at? Was you want to come way to your own father, you young whip? This boy is getting too many from me," said Mr. Cruncher, surveying him. "Him and his hoorahs. Don't let me hear no more of you, or you shall fool some more of me. Do you hear?" "I warn't doing no harm," young Jerry protested, rubbing his cheek.
"Drop it then," said Mr. Cruncher. "I won't have none of your no arms. Get a top of that there seat and look at the crowd."
His son obeyed, and the crowd approached. They were bawling and hissing round a dingy hearse and dingy mourning coach, in which mourning coach there was only one mourner, dressed in the dingy trappings that were considered essential to the dignity of the position. The position appeared by no means to please him, however, with an increasing rabble surrounding the coach, deriding him, making grimaces at him, and incessantly groaning and calling out,
"Yah! Spies! Yah! Spies!"
with many compliments, too numerous and forcible to repeat. Funerals had at all times a remarkable attraction for Mr. Cruncher. He always pricked up his senses and became excited when a funeral passed Tellson's. Naturally, therefore, a funeral with this uncommon attendance excited him greatly, and he asked of the first man who ran against him,
"What is it, brother? What's it all about?"
"I don't know," said the man.
"Spies! Yeah! Spies!"
he asked another man.
"Who is it?" "I don't know," returned the man, clapping his hands to his mouth, nevertheless, and vociferating in a surprising heat and with the greatest ardour, "Spies! Yeah! Spies!"
At length a person better informed on the merits of the case tumbled against him, and from this person he learned that the funeral was the funeral of one Roger Cly.
"Was he a spy?"
asked Mr. Cruncher.
"Old Bailey spy," returned his informant. "Yeah, yeah, Old Bailey spy, eyes."
"Why, to be sure,"
exclaimed Jerry, recalling the trial at which he had assisted.
"I've seen him. Dead, is he?"
"Dead as mutton,"
returned the other.
"And can't be too dead. Have him out there,"
Spies! Put 'em out there! Spies!"
The idea was so acceptable in the prevalent absence of any idea that the crowd caught it up with eagerness, and loudly repeating the suggestion to have 'em out and to pull 'em out, mobbed the two vehicles so closely that they came to a stop. On the crowd's opening the coach doors, the one mourner scuffled out of himself and was in their hands for a moment, but he was so alert and made such good use of his time that in another moment he was scouring away up a by-street after shedding his cloak, hat, long hatband, white pocket handkerchief, and other symbolical tears. These the people tore to pieces and scattered far and wide with great enjoyment, while the tradesmen hurriedly shut up their shops, for a crowd in those times stopped at nothing, and was a monster much dreaded. They had already got the length of opening the hearse to take the coffin out, when some brighter genius proposed instead its being escorted to its destination amidst general rejoicing. Practical suggestions being much needed, this suggestion, too, was received with acclamation, and the coach was immediately filled with 8 inside and a dozen out, while as many people got on the roof of the hearse as could by any exercise of ingenuity stick upon it. Among the first of these volunteers was Jerry Cruncher himself, who modestly concealed his spiky head from the observation of Tellson's in the further corner of the mourning coach. The officiating undertakers made some protest against these changes in the ceremonies, but the river being alarmingly near, and several voices remarking on the efficacy of cold immersion in bringing refractory members of the profession to reason, the protest was faint and brief. The remodelled procession started, with the chimney sweep driving the hearse, advised by the regular driver, who was perched beside him, under close inspection for the purpose, and with a pieman, also attended by his cabinet minister, driving the mourning coach. A bear leader, a popular street character of the time, was impressed as an additional ornament before the cavalcade had gone far down the Strand, and his bear, who was black and very mangy, gave quite an undertaking air to that part of the procession in which he walked. Thus, with beer drinking, pipe smoking, song roaring, and infinite caricaturing of woe, the disorderly procession went its way, recruiting at every step, and all the shops shutting up before it. Its destination was the old church of St. Pancras, far off in the fields. It got there in the course of time, insisting on pouring into the burial ground. Finally accomplished the interment of the deceased Roger Cly in its own way, and highly to its own satisfaction. The dead man disposed of, and the crowd being under the necessity of providing some other entertainment for itself, another brighter genius, or perhaps the same, conceived the humour of impeaching casual passers-by as Old Bailey spies, and wreaking vengeance on them. Chase was given to some scores of inoffensive persons who had never been near the Old Bailey in their lives, in the realisation of this fancy, and they were roughly hustled and maltreated. The transition to the sport of window-breaking, and thence to the plundering of public houses, was easy and natural. At last, after several hours, when sundry summer-houses had been pulled down, and some area railings had been torn up to arm the more belligerent spirits, a rumour got about that the guards were coming. Before this rumour, the crowd gradually melted away, and perhaps the guards came, and perhaps they never came. And this was the usual progress of a mob. Mr. Cruncher did not assist at the closing sports, but had remained behind in the churchyard to confer and condole with the undertakers. The place had a soothing influence on him. He procured a pipe from a neighbouring public house and smoked it, looking in at the railings and maturely considering the spot.
"Jerry," said Mr. Cruncher, apostrophizing himself in his usual way, "you see that there Clyde that day, and you see with your own eyes that he was a young 'un and a straight maiden."
Having smoked his pipe out and ruminated a little longer, he turned himself about that he might appear before the hour of closing on his station at Tellson's. Whether his meditations on mortality had touched his liver, or whether his general health had been previously at all amiss, or whether he desired to show a little attention to an eminent man, is not so much to the purpose as that he made a short call upon his medical adviser, a distinguished surgeon, on his way back. Young Jerry relieved his father with dutiful interest and reported no job in his absence. The bank closed, the ancient clerks came out, the usual watch was set, and Mr. Cruncher and his son went home to tea.
"Now, I'll tell you where it is," said Mr. Cruncher to his wife on entering. "If, as a honest tradesman, my wenches goes wrong tonight, I shall make sure that you've been playing agin me, and I shall work you for it just the same as if I'd seen you do it."
The dejected Mrs. Cruncher shook her head.
"Why, you're at it afore my face,"
said Mr. Cruncher, with signs of angry apprehension.
"I'm saying nothing." "Well, then, don't meditate nothing. You might as well flop as meditate. You might as well go agin me one way as another. Drop it altogether."
"Yes, Jerry."
"Yes, Jerry,"
repeated Mr. Cruncher, sitting down to tea.
"Oh, it is yes, Jerry. That's about it. You may say yes, Jerry."
Mr. Cruncher had no particular meaning in these sulky corroborations, but made use of them, as people not unfrequently do, to express general ironical dissatisfaction.
"You and your yes, Jerry,"
said Mr. Cruncher, taking a bite out of his bread and butter and seeming to help it down with a large, invisible oyster out of his saucer.
"Oh, I think so. I believe you."
"You are going out tonight?"
asked his decent wife, when he took another bite.
"Yes, I am."
"May I go with you, father?"
asked his son briskly.
"No, you mayn't. I'm a-going, as your mother knows, a-fishing. That's where I'm going to. Going a-fishing."
"Your fishing rod gets rather rusty, don't it, father?"
"Never you mind."
"Shall you bring any fish home, father?"
"If I don't, you'll have short commons tomorrow,"
returned that gentleman, shaking his head.
"That's questions enough for you. I ain't a-going out till you've been long abed."
He devoted himself during the remainder of the evening to keeping a most vigilant watch on Mrs. Cruncher, and sullenly holding her in conversation, that she might be prevented from meditating any petitions to his disadvantage. With this view, he urged his son to hold her in conversation also, and led the unfortunate woman a hard life by dwelling on any causes of complaint he could bring against her, rather than he would leave her for a moment to her own reflections. The devoutest person could have rendered no greater homage to the efficacy of an honest prayer than he did in this distrust of his wife. It was as if a professed unbeliever in ghosts should be frightened by a ghost story.
"And mind you," said Mr. Cruncher, "no games tomorrow. If I, as an honest tradesman, succeed in providing a joint of meat or two, none of you are not touching of it and sticking to bread. If I, as an honest tradesman, am able to provide a little beer, none of you are declaring on water. When you go to Rome, do as Rome does. Rome will be an ugly customer to you if you don't. I'm your Rome, you know."
Then he began grumbling again. "With your flying into the face of your own wittles and drink. I don't know how scarce you make the wittles and drink here by your flopping tricks and your unfeeling conduct. Look at your boy. He is yourn, ain't he? He's as thin as a lath. Do you call yourself a mother and not know that a mother's first duty is to blow her boy out?" This touched young Jerry on a tender place, who adjured his mother to perform her first duty, and whatever else she did or neglected, above all things, to lay especial stress on the discharge of that maternal function so affectingly and delicately indicated by his other parent. Thus the evening wore away with the Cruncher family, until young Jerry was ordered to bed, and his mother, laid under similar injunctions, obeyed them. Mr. Cruncher beguiled the earlier watches of the night with solitary pipes, and did not start upon his excursion until nearly 1 o'clock. Towards that small and ghostly hour, he rose up from his chair, took a key out of his pocket, opened a locked cupboard, and brought forth a sack, a crowbar of convenient size, a rope and chain, and other fishing tackle of that nature. Disposing these articles about him in skilful manner, he bestowed a parting defiance on Mrs. Cruncher, extinguished the light, and went out. Young Jerry, who had only made a feint of undressing when he went to bed, was not long after his father. Under cover of the darkness, he followed out of the room, followed down the stairs, followed down the court, followed out into the streets. He was in no uneasiness concerning his getting into the house again, for it was full of lodgers, and the door stood ajar all night. Impelled by a laudable ambition to study the art and mystery of his father's honest calling, young Jerry, keeping as close to house fronts, walls, and doorways as his eyes were close to one another, held his honoured parent in view. The honoured parent, steering northward, had not gone far when he was joined by another disciple of Isaac Walton, and the two trudged on together. Within half an hour from the first starting, they were beyond the winking lamps and the more than winking watchmen, and were out upon a lonely road. Another fisherman was picked up here, and that so silently that if young Jerry had been superstitious, he might have supposed the second follower of the gentle craft to have, all of a sudden, split himself into two. The three went on. Young Jerry went on until the three stopped under a bank overhanging the road. Upon the top of the bank was a low brick wall, surmounted by an iron railing. In the shadow of bank and wall, the three turned out of the road and up a blind lane, of which the wall, there risen to some 8 or 10 feet high, formed one side. Crouching down in a corner, peeping up the lane, the next object that young Jerry saw was the form of his honoured parent, pretty well defined against a watery and clouded moon, nimbly scaling an iron gate. He was soon over, and then the second fisherman got over, and then the third. They all dropped softly on the ground within the gate, and lay there a little, listening, perhaps. Then they moved away on their hands and knees. It was now young Jerry's turn to approach the gate, which he did, holding his breath. Crouching down again in a corner there, and looking in, he made out the three fishermen creeping through some rank grass, and all the gravestones in the churchyard — it was a large churchyard that they were in — looking on like ghosts in white, while the church tower itself looked on like the ghost of a monstrous giant. They did not creep far before they stopped and stood upright. And then they began to fish. They fished with a spade at first. Presently the honoured parent appeared to be adjusting some instrument like a great corkscrew. Whatever tools they worked with, they worked hard, until the awful striking of the church clock so terrified young Jerry that he made off with his hair as stiff as his father's. But his long-cherished desire to know more about these matters not only stopped him in his running away, but lured him back again. They were still fishing, perseveringly, when he peeped in at the gate for the second time. But now they seemed to have got a bite. There was a screwing and complaining sound down below, and their bent figures were strained, as if by a weight. By slow degrees, the weight broke away the earth upon it, and came to the surface. Young Jerry very well knew what it would be, but when he saw it, and saw his honoured parent about to wrench it open, he was so frightened, being new to the sight, that he made off again, and never stopped until he had run a mile or more. He would not have stopped then, for anything less necessary than breath, it being a spectral sort of race that he ran, and one highly desirable to get to the end of. He had a strong idea that the coffin he had seen was running after him, and pictured us hopping on behind him, bolt upright upon its narrow end, always on the point of overtaking him, and hopping on at his side, perhaps taking his arm. It was a pursuer to shun. It was an inconsistent and ubiquitous fiend, too, for while it was making the whole night behind him dreadful, he darted out into the roadway to avoid dark alleys. fearful of its coming hopping out of them like a dropsical boy's kite without tail and wings. It hid in doorways, too, rubbing its horrible shoulders against doors and drawing them up to its ears as if it were laughing. It got into shadows on the road and lay cunningly on its back to trip him up. All this time it was incessantly hopping on behind and gaining on him, so that when the boy got to his own door, he had reason for being half-dead. And even then it would not leave him, but followed him upstairs with a bump on every stair, scrambled into bed with him, and bumped down, dead and heavy, on his breast when he fell asleep. From his oppressed slumber, young Jerry in his closet was awakened after daybreak and before sunrise by the presence of his father in the family room. Something had gone wrong with him. At least so young Jerry inferred from the circumstance of his holding Mrs. Cruncher by the ears and knocking the back of her head against the headboard of the bed.
"I told you I would," said Mr. Cruncher, "and I did." "Jerry, Jerry, Jerry," his wife implored. "You oppose yourself to the profit of the business," said Jerry, "and me and my partners suffer. You was to honour and obey. Why the devil don't you?"
"I try to be a good wife, Jerry,"
the poor woman protested with tears.
"Is it being a good wife to oppose your husband's business? Is it honouring your husband to dishonour his business? Is it obeying your husband to disobey him on the vital subject of his business?
You have taken to the dreadful business then, Jerry."
"It's enough for you," retorted Mr. Cruncher, "to be the wife of an honest tradesman, and not to occupy your female mind with calculations when he took to his trade or when he didn't. The honouring and obeying wife would let his trade alone altogether. Call yourself a religious woman? If you're a religious woman, give me a irreligious one. You have no more natural sense of duty than the bed of this here Thames River has of a pile. And similarly, it must be knocked into you."
The altercation was conducted in a low tone of voice, and terminated in the honest tradesman's kicking off his clay-soiled boots and lying down at his length on the floor. After taking a timid peep at him lying on his back, with his rusty hands under his head for a pillow, his son lay down too, and fell asleep again. There was no fish for breakfast, and not much of anything else. Mr. Cruncher was out of spirits and out of temper, and kept an iron pot lid by him as a projectile for the correction of Mrs. Cruncher in case he should observe any symptoms of her saying grace. He was brushed and washed at the usual hour, and set off with his son to pursue his ostensible calling. Young Jerry, walking with the stool under his arm at his father's side along sunny and crowded Fleet Street, was a very different young Jerry from him of the previous night, running home through darkness and solitude from his grim pursuer. His cunning was fresh with the day, and his qualms were gone with the night, in which particulars it is not improbable that he had compeers in Fleet Street and the City of London that fine morning. "Father," said young Jerry, as they walked along, taking care to keep at arm's length and to have the stool well between them.
"What's a resurrection, man?"
Mr. Cruncher came to a stop on the pavement before he answered,
"How should I know?"
"I thought you knowed everything, father,"
said the artless boy.
"Well,"
returned Mr. Cruncher, going on again and lifting off his hat to give his spikes free play,
"he's a tradesman."
"What's his goods, father?"
asked the brisk young Jerry.
"His goods," said Mr. Cruncher, after turning it over in his mind, "is a branch of scientific goods."
"Person's bodies, ain't it, father?"
asked the lively boy.
"I believe it is something of that sort," said Mr. Cruncher.
"Oh, father, I should so like to be a resurrection man when I'm quite growed up."
Mr. Cruncher was soothed, but shook his head in a dubious and moral way.
"It depends upon how you develop your talents. Be careful to develop your talents, and never to say no more than you can help to nobody. And there's no telling at the present time what you may not come to be fit for."
As young Jerry, thus encouraged, went on a few yards in advance to plant the stool in the shadow of the bar, Mr. Cruncher added to himself,
"Jerry, you honest tradesman, there's hopes what that boy will yet be a blessing to you, and a recompense to you for his mother.
Chapter 15. Knitting. There had been earlier drinking than usual in the wine shop of Monsieur Defarge. As early as 6 o'clock in the morning, sallow faces, peeping through its barred windows, had descried other faces within, bending over measures of wine. Monsieur Defarge sold a very thin wine at the best of times, but it would seem to have been an unusually thin wine that he sold at this time. A sour wine, moreover, or a souring, for its influence on the mood of those who drank it was to make them gloomy. No vivacious bacchanalian flame leapt out of the pressed grape of Monsieur Defarge, but a smouldering fire that burnt in the dark lay hidden in the dregs of it. This had been the third morning in succession on which they had been early drinking at the wine shop of Monsieur Defarge. It had begun on Monday, and here was Wednesday come. There had been more of early brooding than drinking, for many men had listened and whispered and slunk about there from the time of the opening of the door, who could not have laid a piece of money on the counter to save their souls. These were to the full as interested in the place, however, as if they could have commanded whole barrels of wine, and they glided from seat to seat and from corner to corner, swallowing talk in lieu of drink, with greedy looks. Notwithstanding an unusual flow of company, the master of the wine shop was not visible. He was not missed, for nobody who crossed the threshold looked for him, nobody asked for him, nobody wondered to see only Madame Defarge in her seat, presiding over the distribution of wine with a bowl of battered small coins before her, as much defaced and beaten out of their original impress as the small coinage of humanity, from whose ragged pockets they had come. A suspended interest and a prevalent absence of mind were perhaps observed by the spies who looked in at the wine shop, as they looked in at every place, high and low, from the king's palace to the criminal's jail. Games at cards languished. Players at dominoes musingly built towers with them. Drinkers drew figures on the tables with spilt drops of wine. Madame Defarge herself picked out the pattern on her sleeve with her toothpick and saw and heard something inaudible and invisible a long way off. Thus Saint-Antoine in this vinous feature of his until midday. It was high noontide when two dusty men passed through his streets and under his swinging lamps, of whom one was Monsieur Defarge, the other a mender of roads in a blue cap. All adust and athirst, the two entered the wine shop. Their arrival had lighted a kind of fire in the breast of Saint-Antoine, fast spreading as they came along, which stirred and flickered in flames of faces at most doors and windows. Yet no one had followed them, and no man spoke when they entered the wine shop, though the eyes of every man there were turned upon them. "Good day, gentlemen," said Monsieur Defarge. It may have been a signal for loosening the general tongue. It elicited an answering chorus of "Good day." "It is bad weather, gentlemen," said Defarge, shaking his head, upon which every man looked at his neighbour, and then all cast down their eyes and sat silent, except one man, who got up and went out. "My wife," said Defarge, aloud, addressing Madame Defarge, "I have travelled certain leagues with this good mender of roads, called Jacques. I met him, by accident, a day and a half's journey out of Paris. He is a good child, this mender of roads, called Jacques. Give him to drink, my wife." A second man got up and went out. Madame Defarge set wine before the mender of roads called Jacques, who doffed his blue cap to the company and drank. In the breast of his blouse he carried some coarse dark bread. He ate of this between whiles, and sat munching and drinking near Madame Defarge's counter. A third man got up and went out. Defarge refreshed himself with a draught of wine, but he took less than was given to the stranger, as being himself a man to whom it was no rarity, and stood waiting until the countryman had made his breakfast. He looked at no one present, and no one now looked at him, not even Madame Defarge, who had taken up her knitting and was at work. "Have you finished your repast, friend?" he asked, in due season.
"Yes, thank you."
"Come, then. You shall see the apartment that I told you you could occupy. It will suit you to a marvel." Out of the wine shop into the street, out of the street into a courtyard, out of the courtyard up a steep staircase, out of the staircase into a garret, formerly the garret where a white-haired man sat on a low bench, stooping forward, and very busy, making shoes. No white-haired man was there now, but the three men were there who had gone out of the wine shop singly. And between them and the white-haired man afar off was the one small link that they had once looked in at him through the chinks in the wall. Defarge closed the door carefully and spoke in a subdued voice.
"Jacques One, Jacques Two, Jacques Three. This is the witness encountered by appointment by me, Jacques Four. He will tell you all. Speak. Jacques Five."
The mender of roads, blue cap in hand, wiped his swarthy forehead with it and said,
"Where shall I commence, monsieur?"
"Commence," was Monsieur Defarge's not unreasonable reply, "at the commencement."
"I saw him then, monsieur," began the mender of roads, "a year ago, this running summer, underneath the carriage of the Marquis, hanging by the chain. Behold the manner of it. I, leaving my work on the road, the sun going to bed, the carriage of the Marquis slowly ascending the hill, he hanging by the chain, like this."
Again the mender of roads went through the whole performance, in which he ought to have been perfect by that time, seeing that it had been the infallible resource and indispensable entertainment of his village during a whole year. Jacques One struck in, and asked if he had ever seen the man before.
"Never,"
answered the mender of roads, recovering his perpendicular. Jacques Three demanded how he afterwards recognized him then.
"By his tall figure,"
said the mender of roads, softly, and with his finger at his nose.
"When Monsieur the Marquis demands that evening, 'Say, what is he like?' I make response, 'Tall as a spectre.'"
"You should have said, 'Short as a dwarf,'" returned Jacques Two.
"But what did I know? The deed was not then accomplished. Neither did he confide in me. Observe, under those circumstances even I do not offer my testimony. Monsieur the Marquis indicates me with his finger, standing near our little fountain, and says, 'To me, bring that rascal.' My faith, monsieur, I offer nothing."
"He is right there, Jacques," murmured Defarge to him who had interrupted. "Go on."
"Good,"
said the mender of roads, with an air of mystery.
"The tall man is lost, and he is sought."
"How many months?"
9, 10, 11.
"No matter the number," said Defarge. "He is well hidden, but at last he is unluckily found. Go on."
"I'm again at work upon the hillside, and the sun is again about to go to bed. I'm collecting my tools to descend to my cottage down in the village below, where it is already dark, when I raise my eyes and see coming over the hill 6 soldiers. In the midst of them is a tall man with his arms bound, tied to his sides, like this."
With the aid of his indispensable cap, he represented a man with his elbows bound fast at his hips, with cords that were knotted behind him.
"I stand aside, monsieur, by my heap of stones, to see the soldiers and their prisoners pass, for it is a solitary road, that, where any spectacle is well worth looking at. And at first, as they approach, I see no more than that they are 6 soldiers with a tall man bound, and that they are almost black to my sight, except on the side of the sun going to bed, where they have a red edge, monsieur."
Also, I see that their long shadows are on the hollow ridge on the opposite side of the road, and are on the hill above it, and are like the shadows of giants. Also, I see that they are covered with dust, and that the dust moves with them as they come, tramp, tramp. But when they advance quite near to me, I recognize the tall man, and he recognizes me. Ah, but he would be well content to precipitate himself over the hillside once again, as on the evening when he and I first encountered close to the same spot. He described it as if he were there, and it was evident that he saw it vividly. Perhaps he had not seen much in his life. I do not show the soldiers that I recognize the tall man. He does not show the soldiers that he recognizes me. We do it, and we know it, with our eyes. Come on, says the chief of that company, pointing to the village. Bring him fast to his tomb, and they bring him faster. I follow. His arms are swell because of being bound so tight. His wooden shoes are large and clumsy, and he's lame. Because he's lame and consequently slow, they drive him with their guns. Like this. He imitated the action of a man's being impelled forward by the butt-ends of muskets. As they descend the hill like madmen running a race, he falls. They laugh and pick him up again. His face is bleeding and covered with dust, but he cannot touch it. Thereupon they laugh again. They bring him into the village. All the village runs to look. They take him past the mill and up to the prison. All the village sees the prison gate open in the darkness of the night and swallow him. Like this. He opened his mouth as wide as he could, and shut it with a sounding snap of his teeth. Observant of his unwillingness to mar the effect by opening it again, Defarge said, "Go on, Jack." "All the village," pursued the mender of roads, on tiptoe and in a low voice, "withdraws. All the village dreams of that unhappy one, within the locks and bars of the prison on the crag, and never to come out of it, except to perish. In the morning, with my tools upon my shoulder, eating my morsel of black bread as I go, I make a circuit by the prison on my way to my work. There I see him, high up behind the bars of a lofty iron cage, bloody and dusty as last night, looking through. He has no hand free to wave to me. I dare not call to him. He regards me like a dead man."
Defarge and the three glanced darkly at one another. The looks of all of them were dark, repressed, and revengeful, as they listened to the countryman's story. The manner of all of them, while it was secret, was authoritative, too. They had the air of a rough tribunal. Jacques One and Two sitting on the old pallet bed, each with his chin resting on his hand and his eyes intent on the road mender. Jacques Three, equally intent, on one knee behind them, with his agitated hand always gliding over the network of fine nerves about his mouth and nose. Defarge, standing between them and the narrator, whom he had stationed in the light of the window, by turns, looking from him to them, and from them to him.
"Go on, Jacques," said Defarge.
"He remains up there in his iron cage some days. The village looks at him by stealth, for it is afraid. But it always looks up, from a distance, at the prison on the crag. And in the evening, when the work of the day is achieved, and it assembles to gossip at the fountain, all faces are turned towards the prison. Formerly, they were turned towards the posting-house. Now they are turned towards the prison. They whisper at the fountain that although condemned to death, he will not be executed. They say that petitions have been presented in Paris, showing that he was enraged and made mad by the death of his child. They say that a petition has been presented to the king himself. What do I know? Is this possible? Perhaps yes. Perhaps no."
"Listen, then, Jacques," Number One of that name sternly interposed. "Know that a petition was presented to the king and queen. All here, yourself excepted, saw the king take it in his carriage in the street, sitting beside the queen. 'Tis Defarge, whom you see here, who, at the hazard of his life, darted out before the horses with the petition in his hand.
once again. "Listen, Jacques," said the kneeling number three, his fingers ever wandering over and over those fine nerves with a strikingly greedy air, as if he hungered for something that was neither food nor drink. The guard, horse and foot, surrounded the petitioner and struck him blows. "You hear?"
"I hear, messieurs."
"Go on, then," said Defarge.
"Again, on the other hand, they whisper at the fountain,"
resumed the countryman,
"that he is brought down into our country to be executed on the spot, and that he will very certainly be executed. They even whisper that because he has slain Monseigneur, and because Monseigneur was the father of his tenants, serfs, what you will, he will be executed as a parricide. One old man says at the fountain that his right hand, armed with the knife, will be burnt off before his face, that into wounds which will be made in his arms, his breast, and his legs, there will be poured boiling oil, melted lead, hot resin, wax, and sulphur. Finally, that he will be torn limb from limb by four strong horses. That old man says all this was actually done to a prisoner who made an attempt on the life of the late King Louis XV. But how do I know if he lies? I am not a scholar."
"Listen once again, then, Jacques," said the man with the restless hand and the craving air. "The name of that prisoner was Damiens, and it was all done in one day in the open streets of this city of Paris, and nothing was more noticed in the vast concourse that saw it done than the crowd of ladies of quality and fashion, who were full of eager attention to the last. To the last, Jacques, prolonged until nightfall, when he had lost two legs and an arm, and still breathed. And it was done... Why, how old are you?"
35,
said the mender of roads, who looked 60. "It was done when you were more than 10 years old. You might have seen it." "Enough," said Defarge, with grim impatience. "Long live the devil. Go on."
"Well, some whisper this, some whisper that. They speak of nothing else. Even the fountain appears to fall to that tune. At length, on Sunday night, when all the village is asleep, come soldiers winding down from the prison, and their guns ring on the stones of the little street. Workmen dig, workmen hammer. Soldiers laugh and sing. In the morning, by the fountain, there is raised a gallows 40 feet high, poisoning the water."
The mender of roads looked through rather than at the low ceiling, and pointed as if he saw the gallows somewhere in the sky.
"All work is stopped. All assemble there. Nobody leads the cows out. The cows are there with the rest. At midday, the roll of drums. Soldiers have marched into the prison in the night, and he is in the midst of many soldiers. He is bound, as before, and in his mouth there is a gag. Tied, so, with a tight string, making him look almost as if he laughed."
He suggested it by creasing his face with his two thumbs from the corners of his mouth to his ears.
"On the top of the gallows is fixed the knife, blade upwards with its point in the air. He is hanged there 40 feet high, and is left hanging, poisoning the water."
They looked at one another as he used his blue cap to wipe his face, on which the perspiration had started afresh while he recalled the spectacle.
"It is frightful, monsieur. How can the women and the children draw water? Who can gossip of an evening under that shadow?" "Under it," am I said, "when I left the village Monday evening as the sun was going to bed and looked back from the hill, the shadow struck across the church, across the mill, across the prison, seemed to strike across the earth, monsieur, to where the sky rests upon it."
The hungry man gnawed one of his fingers as he looked at the other three, and his finger quivered with the craving that was on him.
"That's all, monsieur. I left at sunset, as I had been warned to do, and I walked on that night and half next day until I met, as I was warned I should, this comrade. With him I came on, now riding and now walking, through the rest of yesterday and through last night. And here you see me.
After a gloomy silence, the first Jacques said,
"Good. You have acted and recounted faithfully. Will you wait for us a little outside the door?"
"Very willingly,"
said the mender of roads, whom Defarge escorted to the top of the stairs, and leaving seated there, returned. The three had risen, and their heads were together when he came back to the garret.
"How say you, Jacques?" demanded number one. "To be registered?"
"To be registered as doomed to destruction," returned Defarge.
"Magnificent," croaked the man with the craving.
"The chateau and all the race?"
inquired the first. "The chateau and all the race," returned Defarge. "Extermination." The hungry man repeated in a rapturous croak,
"Magnificent!"
and began gnawing another finger.
"Are you sure," asked Jacques Two of Defarge, "that no embarrassment can arise from our manner of keeping the register? Without doubt it is safe, for no one beyond ourselves can decipher it. But shall we always be able to decipher it? Or, I ought to say, will she?"
"Jacques," returned Defarge, drawing himself up, "if Madame, my wife, undertook to keep the register in her memory alone, she would not lose a word of it, not a syllable of it. Knitted in her own stitches and her own symbols, it will always be as plain to her as the sun. Confide in Madame Defarge. It would be easier for the weakest poltroon that lives to erase himself from existence than to erase one letter of his name or crimes from the knitted register of Madame Defarge." There was a murmur of confidence and approval, and then the man who hungered asked,
"Is this rustic to be sent back soon?" "I hope so. He's very simple. Is he not a little dangerous?"
"He knows nothing," said Defarge, "at least nothing more than would easily elevate himself to a gallows of the same height. I charge myself with him. Let him remain with me. I will take care of him and set him on his road. He wishes to see the fine world, the king, the queen, and court. Let him see them on Sunday."
"What?" exclaimed the hungry man, staring. "Is it a good sign that he wishes to see royalty and nobility?"
"Jacques," said Defarge, "judiciously show a cat milk if you wish her to thirst for it. Judiciously show a dog his natural prey if you wish him to bring it down one day." Nothing more was said, and the mender of roads, being found already dozing on the topmost stair, was advised to lay himself down on the pallet bed and take some rest. He needed no persuasion, and was soon asleep. Worse quarters than Defarge's wine shop could easily have been found in Paris for a provincial slave of that degree. Saving for a mysterious dread of Madame, by which he was constantly haunted, his life was very new and agreeable. But Madame sat all day at her counter, so expressly unconscious of him, and so particularly determined not to perceive that his being there had any connection with anything below the surface, that he shook in his wooden shoes whenever his eye lighted on her. For he contended with himself that it was impossible to foresee what that lady might pretend next. And he felt assured that if she should take it into her brightly ornamented head to pretend that she had seen him do a murder and afterwards flay the victim, she would infallibly go through with it until the play was played out. Therefore, when Sunday came, the mender of roads was not enchanted, though he said he was, to find that Madame was to accompany Monsieur and himself to Versailles. It was additionally disconcerting to have Madame knitting all the way there in a public conveyance. It was additionally disconcerting yet to have Madame in the crowd in the afternoon, still with her knitting in her hands, as the crowd waited to see the carriage of the King and Queen.
"You work hard, Madame?"
said a man near her.
"Yes," answered Madame Defarge, "I have a good deal to do." "What do you make, Madame?"
"Many things."
"For instance?"
"For instance," returned Madame Defarge composedly, "shrouds." The man moved a little further away as soon as he could, and the mender of roads fanned himself with his blue cap, feeling it mightily close and oppressive. If he needed a king and queen to restore him, he was fortunate in having his remedy at hand. For soon the large-faced king and the fair-faced queen came in their golden coats.